From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. President Trump is calling today's New York Times report about a plan to send 120,000 troops to Iran fake news, going on to say, would I do that? Absolutely, but we haven't planned. The New York Times says the plan was presented by his acting defense secretary at a meeting of top-level advisors, including John Bolton. Troops would be deployed if Iran attacked U.S. forces or enriched uranium, a violation of the nuclear deal, and something Iran's president threatened unless countries hammer out a new Iran deal, a sign that Iran has been hurt by sanctions imposed by President Trump after he pulled the U.S. out of the deal last year, even though observers say Iran was abiding by it. The U.S. has already sent B-52 bombers to the region, and several ships, including from Saudi Arabia, were sabotaged near the UAE last weekend. Admiral James Stavridis is former Supreme Allied Commander of NATO. Admiral, the president denies it, but your reaction when you read about this plan?
I was concerned, and I continue to be concerned, about rising force levels in the Gulf because this can lead to miscalculation. So really the thing to focus on is the arrival of the aircraft carrier Abraham Lincoln, its associated strike group, the ships that go with it, the deployment of B-52 and F-15 bombers and fighters, respectively. Those are the strike weapons that would be used. The 120,000 troops is more of an insurance policy. It's much longer term. The worry at the moment, Robin, is a miscalculation on the waters of the Arabian Gulf between Iranian naval forces and U.S. naval forces.
Well, this was the opinion that it was expressed to Secretary of State Mike Pompeo yesterday when he crashed that meeting of countries that are still signed onto the Iran nuclear deal. These are European allies who said to him that very same thing. They were worried that tensions might boil over inadvertently. You have that same concern. The more there is a target, the more there is a chance that something might get hit.
Precisely. And let's add to it the fact that over the last 2 days, we've seen a series of mysterious explosions directed against tankers operating off the coast of the United Arab Emirates, including both Saudi, UAE, and at least one European Norwegian ship involved in that. Appears a possibility of sabotage or mines. This would be a classic Iranian move that could cause a counter-reaction from U.S. forces, and then we could see a world in which escalation continues. That's what ultimately could lead to a troop deployment. Boy, let's hope we don't get there.
Well, in fact, when it comes to that incident, an Iranian foreign ministry spokesman called it a regretful incident, but there is speculation that Iran might be behind it, and Iran is saying that it might have been some sort of mistake.
I would say at this point, we don't have the facts in front of us. A good voice to listen to is our current ambassador to Saudi Arabia, former General John Abizaid. He is counseling, let's take a deep breath, let's get the facts here, let us not stumble into some kind of a hot conflict.
Well, and to be very clear, this meeting was specifically not about some sort of land invasion. President Trump was asked yesterday, are you looking for regime change in Iran? And he said, let's see what happens with Iran. If they do anything, it would be a very bad mistake. Right now, nobody is saying this would be a land invasion, but it's about the same number of troops that was used to invade Iraq.
Two very different circumstances. The 120,000 number would actually be insufficient to conduct a significant land incursion into Iran. I would speculate, and this would be speculation, that the 120,000 number is more about defensive positioning around our many, many bases in the region in case we ramped up air and naval attacks, and the Iranians then reacted with a land assault.
Well, what do you think is going on here? Because the Times story was based on many interviews with a number of national security officials who were in that meeting, who were briefed on these plans, who seemed alarmed by them. There's been reporting that President Trump is even a bit, maybe alarmed is not the right word, but not aligned with his advisor, John Bolton, who's a well-known hardliner. He made some of the same suggestions about bringing down Tehran during the George W. Bush administration. Those were ignored. It's well known where he stands, but it seems as if there's a rift here. What do you think is going on?
I think rift is perhaps exactly the right word. We see National Security Advisor Bolton has consistently pushed for regime change in Iran. President Trump, however, is beginning to really focus not on the Middle East, but on re-election. And if you look 18 months out, I'll use a technical term of diplomacy here. He needs a war in the Middle East like he needs a hole in the head. And if that is a deterrent from a conflict with Iran, I'm fine with it.
James Stavridis, former Navy Admiral, now operating executive at the Carlyle Group in Washington, D.C. Admiral Stavridis, thanks as always.
My pleasure to be with you. Let's hope things de-escalate.
Well, Apple's stock price rebounded somewhat this morning after dropping nearly 6% yesterday, in part because of the trade war with China, in part because of a Supreme Court ruling that an antitrust lawsuit against the company can move forward. For more, let's go to our weekly guide to the world of tech, Recode. Kara Swisher is editor-at-large for Recode. Hi, Kara.
Hey.
And let's start with the Supreme Court ruling. They haven't decided the merits of the case itself, but they've allowed it to go forward against Apple's objections. Justice Kavanaugh wrote the decision, siding with the court's liberal justices. How bad is this for Apple?
Well, it's not good for all of Silicon Valley, because there's all kinds of companies that aren't really monopolies, but have a lot of power. And so, you know, Apple, you can't call Apple a monopoly precisely. I think it's got 47% of the market share, and up, that's in the U.S., and I think globally, it's much smaller because of Android. But they do run their app platform. And the question is whether they should be separated. The app platform should be separated from the device itself. And that sort of goes to Google has a platform. Everybody has a platform. And so that's the question of what can be separated out.
Well, and it also brings up this question of monopoly in the tech industry, which is something that we're hearing more and more of these days.
Yeah, but they're not. Some of them aren't technically a monopoly. That's the problem. So antitrust law has to change, obviously, to meet the new reality, which is there's a lot of really powerful companies that have big market shares that essentially control things, and that would be, you know, Amazon, Facebook, and Google, and Apple to an extent. It's big, but it's not a monopoly like the way we think of, say, when Microsoft was running the operating system and the apps and the everything.
Mm-hmm. So it's good to have that context there, that it's not technically a monopoly, although let's listen to the person who's been in the news over the last week really making the case about Facebook. This is co-founder Chris Hughes, who wrote an op-ed in the New York Times, and he spoke on NPR's Morning Edition. Here he is.
Mark Zuckerberg is unaccountable. He's unaccountable to his shareholders, he's unaccountable to his users, and he's unaccountable to government. And I think that that's fundamentally un-American, and I think government should step up, break up the company, and regulate it.
Kara, how are the tech companies responding at this point, a week later, to this argument from Hughes and others who've been saying the same thing?
Well, again, it's a different thing with Facebook, because that's a different issue, too, is that Mark controls all the shares at Facebook that count. And so he controls the board and he can't be fired. That's very different. And maybe people shouldn't be allowed to have that. And so it's just a lot of different things going all at once. But essentially, it goes to the idea is that these companies have locked in power for themselves so they can control things. And even if it's not technically a monopoly, it's worrisome to people. Now, every politician in the world is now jumping on the Elizabeth Warren bandwagon, which was started by her. With Chris's, we also did a podcast with him. I mean, the idea is that these platforms might be causing problems and nobody can do anything about it. And so the question is, what can government do about it?
At the same time, the users, it seems like, still want to be able to use these products.
Yeah.
They add a level of convenience. And you know, even after all the warnings that we've had about all the things that tech companies have been doing, we still all just click accept every time they give us a 500-page, you know, document to accept.
Right, yeah. And again, it depends on what you're using. Like, it depends, you know, if you're using Maps, do you agree to be located? Did you not really know what was going on? I mean, it just goes on and on and on. And that's the problem, is that the question is, how much do consumers know about what's going on? How much should they know? How much should they accept? How much should companies like Google and Facebook be able to use your digital information to sell advertising? Now, Apple's not in the advertising business. It's in the device business. But should it be able to run the App Store and it's the only place you can get apps? Each has their own unique problems. And I think antitrust is going to be the way this might change.
You know, the one company that we haven't been talking about in the last few minutes, but I think now falls into this category, is Uber, where the public, the idea from the public is starting to shift.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's a different story. That went public. It just went public itself, and it's not doing very well because mostly its economics are pretty screwy. It loses a lot of money, and the question is, can it ever make money? And the question is, well, maybe it should merge with Lyft, and that'll be like a big question for government. Should that be allowed in this country to have one ride-sharing service, essentially?
Is that being talked about?
You think about it, when they're both of them are really doing badly, and the reason why they're doing badly is that their economics are bad, and the reason their economics are bad is because they're in huge competition and price cutting, and so consumers are getting really low prices for these rides. You know, that's a big people
maybe
wonder
they'll get even bigger. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. But then they get an even bigger, and then we have to break them apart. So, you know, I mean, so that's the issue, is should these platforms like Facebook, which owns Instagram and WhatsApp and other things, should it be able to buy more stuff? I mean, it goes all kinds of ways, and it's not even getting into acquisitions, but I doubt Facebook or Google will be able to buy anything anytime soon, for example, in this atmosphere.
It's Kara Swisher, editor-at-large at Recode. Kara, thanks as always.
Thanks so much.
This week we've been talking to journalist David Wallace Wells, author of Uninhabitable Earth, a new book crammed with science about what carbon emissions are doing to the planet and how little time there is to course correct. You need nerves of steel to read the book, but we'd recommend it. We'll post yesterday's conversation at herenow.org. It was about the big picture, which isn't pretty. David says the only way to stave off calamity and keep warming under 2 degrees, 3 at the very outside, is immediate global policy that zeroes out carbon emissions and funds new technologies. Scientists estimate we have 30 years to succeed. Today, what will happen if we don't? Just this past year, we've seen horrific stories, people trying to escape fast-moving wildfires in their cars or being burned to death in their swimming pools. We're seeing not only an unprecedented number of hurricanes and floods, but those storms are also more powerful, more destructive. I started by asking David whether he was predicting, and scientists are predicting, these types of scenarios multiplied by the thousands.
Yeah, I mean, there's good science that projects that California wildfires could grow as much as 64-fold by the end of the century. Now, there are also reasons that that estimate is almost certainly too high, but it's not irresponsible science. there's a decent reason for thinking at least a doubling and probably a quadrupling of wildfires is likely just by 2050. And, you know, the same is true for flooding and droughts and hurricanes. Everything is going to get more intense. There are projections that by the end of the century, if we don't change course, there will be parts of the world that would be hit by 6 climate-driven natural disasters at once.
Yeah.
Today, air pollution from the burning of fossil fuels kills 9 million people each year. And it's projected that if we don't avoid 2 degrees of warming, 153 million people will die from air pollution alone. Mm. That is the equivalent of 25 Holocausts. And since 2 degrees is about our best-case scenario, I think it's practically speaking baked in. Mm. The thing that scares me most in a kind of reflexive animal way is the effect of climate change and temperature rise on our bodies. So temperature affects cognitive performance. It affects emotional well-being and mood. It affects the rates of autism and ADHD in developing children. The number of days that a baby spends in the womb over 90 degrees can be seen on its lifetime earnings. That's how dramatic the effect of temperature on child development is. And the most, to me, horrifying story in the book isn't about humans at all. It's about the Sayiga antelope, which is this dwarf antelope that lived in Siberia. And a few years ago, I think it was in 2015, the entire species got wiped out because a bacteria that had lived inside their guts for millions of years was rewired by a summer that was especially hot and humid. And what had been a quite happy cohabitant of that Sayiga's digestive tract became an enemy of the animal and killed the entire species. Now, we know at this point, we've learned a lot over the last decade. Humans are complicated biologies as well. We have millions and perhaps billions of bacteria living inside us and viruses living inside us. And while it's probably the case that the overwhelming majority of those won't be affected by temperature rises of just 2 or 3 or 4 degrees, the chance that one of them or several of them is transformed in that way is quite serious. Mm. And that doesn't mean that humans are going to be made extinct, but there's a relationship between schizophrenia and viruses that you've been exposed to. There's a relationship between mood disorders. There's a relationship with obesity. So many aspects of the way that we think of our, you know, relationship to the world are determined in part by these other creatures that are living inside us. And every single one of them is subject to the transformations that will be brought about by climate change.
One of the things that, you know, struck me is you do speak about animals that go extinct and how we feel badly about that, but how we could not be seeing that we are animals too. And so, you know, look in the mirror. Why wouldn't we go the same way?
Yeah, I mean, it's personally, I'm someone who is not all that moved by the plight of animals, but the exact analogy that you made hits me very hard whenever I think about it. The World Wildlife Foundation says that 60% of all vertebrate mammals have died since 1970, and we're an adaptable species. We've adapted to new conditions before. We're sure to do it again. The question is, what will those conditions be, and what transformations of human life will they require for us to continue living here on this planet? But even in that world, our descendants will still be here living in ways I think they actually consider normal and not horrific. But the conditions of possibility will have changed quite dramatically, such that we probably will cease thinking of history as a march of progress and stop thinking of the future as a more prosperous, fulfilling time than the past was. Mm. In part, that's because if we don't change course on carbon by the end of the century, huge parts of the world, the entire equatorial band of the world and many parts of the tropics and the mid-latitudes would have the very prospect of economic growth completely eliminated by the force of climate change. In fact, there was just a paper out saying that some of those effects are already quite visible in the developing world, such that some of the poorest countries in the world have lost as much as a third of their potential GDP over the last few decades because of the impacts of climate change. And those impacts will multiply going forward, such that will be the case that you and I will be probably living in nations that are still able to produce some economic growth. There will be parts of the world that are punished incredibly intensely, namely in South Asia and the Middle East, where as soon as 2050, many of the biggest cities, some of them now home to 12 or 15 million people, could be so hot that if you go outside in the summertime, you're at risk at heat stroke or death. And that's one reason why the UN believes that, again, as soon as 2050, there could be as many as 200 million climate refugees. They think it's possible we could have 1 billion, which is as many people as live in North and South America combined. And when you consider that the Syrian refugee crisis, which was climate-related, if not solely caused by climate, sent just 1 million refugees into Europe and completely scrambled that continent's politics, it gives you a sense of just how fragile our geopolitics are. You know, I'm not personally comfortable saying that Donald Trump or Jair Bolsonaro are creations of
Brazil,
an era of climate change.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But it's also the case that if you were to imagine what politics would emerge from a more dramatically warmed world, more intuitions of resource scarcity, more retreat into nationalistic self-interest and nativism, these are exactly the kinds of figures you might predict. And so I wouldn't be surprised if we see more of them coming forward in the coming years.
Well, you're also mentioning such big numbers. Again, it's hard to take in, but a couple of things. First, we already know that some of the asylum seekers on the southern border are escaping mm-hmm. climate change issues. And one little detail from your book jumped out at me that I could really grasp, but there are already workers in Honduras, Guatemala, in some of these countries affected by drought who are just, their kidneys are failing because they don't have water. But you mentioned these world leaders. Have you thought about, you know, trying to take your book to the White House and knocking on the door and saying, can we just talk off the record? You have a quote here. Could anyone wish his name to be coupled by history with such human degradation and destruction as we know is coming? Have you tried?
I haven't had any direct contact with the Trump White House. I've heard from a lot of political leaders on the other side of the aisle who are actually making quite enormous progress on this in this area. When I started working on climate a few years ago, it was conventional wisdom, which, you know, I sort of took for granted, that the public and our politics was quite inert on this subject, that it just wasn't moving at all and there wasn't much chance for rapid movement. But 73% of Americans now believe in climate change. 70% of them are concerned about it. Those numbers are up 15% since just 2015. They're up 8% since last year. Those are incredibly rapid movements by any political science standard, although they're a little too slow given how fast we need to take action to really avert some catastrophic change. And when you look at the protest movements in EU with the climate strike, in the UK with Extinction Rebellion, in the US with Sunrise, which has produced the Green New Deal, there is just enormous energy, momentum, and pressure because extreme weather is making it impossible, for the first time really impossible, to look away from climate change. We used to believe it could be distant in time and place.
Or maybe not true.
Yeah, and I think that's true of even a liberal like me who was committed to the idea of climate change. I still lived in my everyday life as though it wasn't real, as though it wasn't a major issue. And I think we have to understand that all of us are wired in ways to compartmentalize and live in denial, and fight against that by doing our best to take seriously the science, which really does demand a kind of dramatic, all-encompassing response to avert some of these dramatic, all-encompassing threats that we face.
Do you look at people like Bill McKibben, who, of course, has tried so hard to get this very same message out, journalist, author, activist? It's wearing on him. Is this wearing on you yet?
I think it's wearing on anyone who pays attention. I mean, it imposes an emotional cost on all of us to think about the world suffering in all these ways. Thankfully, though, I think it's all in front of us. If we get to some of these truly terrifying outcomes, it will be because of the choices we make from here on out. Nothing really is baked in stone besides a few more tenths of a degree of warming. Everything is up to what we do. The main input in climate change is how much carbon we put into the atmosphere, and we can choose to put less of it into the atmosphere or none of it. This is a kind of a theological, mythological story. You might feel some of these projections are overwhelmingly scary, and they are, but they're also a reflection of how much power we have over the climate, because we'll be the ones that bring those horrible eventualities into being, and that means we can also choose to not bring them into being if we make the right choices, adopt a new politics, and produce a new set of policies that treat climate change as the story of our time, the story of our century, one that will dominate every aspect of our life, which is how we need to think of it in order to bring about policy that makes the future happily livable for us all.
David Wallace Wells, his new alarming, although with some optimism, a book about climate change, global warming, is The Uninhabitable Earth, Life After Warming. David, thank you so much.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
This message comes from Here and Now's sponsor, Ember Wave. Ember Wave, the revolutionary new personal thermostat that is designed to help you find thermal wellness in any situation. Ember Wave can put you in control of your comfort in places like your freezing office, uncomfortable airplanes, cold restaurants, after a workout, at home, and more. Named one of Time Magazine's best inventions of 2018. Learn more at emberwave.com. Ember Wave, balance through temperature.
Shares of the German pharmaceutical company Bayer fell sharply today after a California jury ordered Bayer to pay $2 billion to a couple who say they got cancer after using the weed killer Roundup for 30 years. This is the eighth largest product defect verdict in U.S. history, the third time in less than a year that Bayer has lost a courtroom battle defending Roundup. Bayer owns Monsanto, which makes Roundup. Ali Velshi is an MSNBC anchor and economics correspondent and co-host of Velshi and Rule. Ali, big statement with this jury, with this big verdict, which might go down. We remember the jury awarded $289 million to a school groundskeeper who got terminal cancer after using Roundup. And that was reduced, I think, to $78 million. But still, big numbers, bad PR. What does this mean for Bayer?
Well, look, it means a lot. It is, Bayer has suffered a great deal of internal criticism from its shareholders about having bought Monsanto. So Monsanto, this is the third chemical-based lawsuit that it has lost, and it's got more than 13,000 on deck. So at the annual meeting at Bayer, there was a movement to sort of a motion, really, to absolve the CEO and the board of making the decision to purchase Monsanto, and it was actually defeated. That very rarely happens. So Monsanto's got problems. Bayer's got problems on the share price. Bayer's got problems from inside, from shareholders, and Bayer's got 13,000 more lawsuits and a $2 billion ruling against it. So At the moment, and these things can work out differently, but at the moment, this is a very, very bad situation for Monsanto and its parent company.
Well, Ali, staying with the business here, here's what we don't understand. I see Roundup on the shelves.
Yes.
Yeah. How is it that it's still on the shelves? We know that Bayer is pointing to statements from the EPA
yep.
that said the main ingredient in Roundup is not a carcinogen, but is that why they have to keep it on the shelves? Because they can't admit that it is?
And if you pick it up on the shelf, you'll notice there is no warning on it other than the poison warnings, the normal warnings that if you consume this, you know, call the poison center. So glyphosate, which is the herbicide that is in there, which is, by the way, the most common herbicide used all over the place, has not been determined by the EPA and by other regulatory agencies to be a carcinogen. This is the problem. Lots of people who have been close to this product for a long time have argued that they've been they've got cancer from it, particularly non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. But the EPA and other regulators haven't found that to be true. So this
but juries have.
Juries have found it to be true. Yeah. And the reason that this one was so big is because it the plaintiffs had more freedom to provide more evidence. And some of that evidence was about how Monsanto didn't seem to want to get to the bottom of whether or not this was carcinogenic. In other words, they seem to be more interested in making sure it sells. This is a huge selling product. Everybody uses it.
Mm.
So the warning issue is important because for gardeners and landscapers, they know they deal with chemicals, so in many cases they use masks and gloves. Some don't, but some do. But this product is sold on the shelf for anybody to use. I grew up with people using Roundup all over. So this is part of the problem. Bayer and Monsanto do not want to say that this thing is a carcinogen and requires a warning because they're already facing 13,000 lawsuits for it.
Well, but they have lost several, and you'd think that that would force a company to say, by the way, juries have decided that this is, you know, is carcinogenic. Ali Velshi, MSNBC anchor, economics correspondent. We'll continue to follow the story.
We absolutely will.
Yeah, 13,000, as you said, pending lawsuits. Thanks so much.
Bye-bye.
Asian markets followed the U.S. market down today after the escalation in the trade war between the two biggest economies in the world, that would be the U.S. and China. And joining us now is Dame Barbara Woodward, who's the British ambassador to China. She's the first woman to hold that position. Welcome to Here and Now.
Thank you very much, Jeremy. It's great to be here.
Well, and starting with the trade war, where does Britain see itself in this trade war? Are you on one side or the other?
We're not on one side or the other. This is the two biggest economies in the world now having really important discussions about opening up China's market and creating a fair and level playing field. So we are very much sharing the concerns that the US has around intellectual property, cybersecurity, access to the market, technology transfer, level playing field. We think we've seen some good progress in China, and indeed UK-China trade has been growing. So we'd very much like to see the trade talks come to a successful conclusion and China's market open up very much in line with the sort of commitments it made when it joined the WTO in 2001.
Does it look like things are progressing in a good way on that front?
I think through the first 10 or 11 rounds, things did seem to be making progress. But obviously, the last round hasn't brought us seemingly any closer to an agreement. Both sides have been clear. The Chinese have now said that there are three conditions really that they want to see. First of all, they want the tariffs removed in any deal. They want procurement to be open in any deal. And they want other things to take account of China's own sensitivities and respect for the country. Obviously, the US side has some important equities driving forward on opening up the market. So there's, I think, optimism still that talks will carry on, but there's not quite clear what the timing on that will be.
Does it seem to you like the trade war and the tariffs are hurting China's economy at all?
Yes. I think the trade war and the tariffs are hurting China's economy. We saw in the first 3 months of this year economic stimulus. So China's overall growth was sustained at about 6.4%. But the reforms that China really needs to move forward to become a highly developed economy, I think, have stalled. So those are the sort of reforms around reforming state-owned enterprise, continuing to move forward on breaking down the negative list, which restricts foreign investment in various sectors. So I think it is beginning to have an impact on the Chinese economy, yes.
And what about the global economy? As the United Kingdom looks on at what's happening between the United States and China, the two biggest economies in the world, Is it hurting the global economy?
Yes, I think it is, because the global economy now, as we all know, is increasingly interconnected. So it's really important that the free and open trading system, which is underpinned by the WTO, is maintained and sustained. We've seen some displacement of trade, which has given short-term boosts, for example, to some countries in Southeast Asia. But long-term, I think having the two biggest economies in the world locked into this sort of trade dispute is worrying for the global economy. And the IMF has also been downgrading its forecasts. So, yes, worrying.
How much do you think that China overall right now is changing, is modernizing?
China is modernizing hugely right now. I first went to China in 1986, and that was right at the beginning of what China thinks of as its reform and opening up policy. The economy has modernized hugely. It is, in very many ways, a functioning market economy. In the private sector now accounts for more than 50% of GDP, and the private sector accounts for around 70% of GDP growth. So there's still a long way to go in terms of tackling modernization, environmental protections, being fully open to international investment. One of the problems we have in the UK is that we are the most open economy in the G20. We've welcomed Chinese investment, and that's not a reciprocal that's not reciprocated.
It's hard for British companies and investors to get involved in China.
It's hard for as many of them as would like to. And we have more than 50,000 British companies from multinationals to SMEs involved in China. But there is scope for so much more that would be mutually beneficial.
Well, that brings us to another issue that's going on, which is Brexit. Yes. And there's been a question, as the Brexit talks have been going on, about whether Britain is going to start signing trade deals with other countries, including China. Yes. Is there any progress on that front?
So we have signaled that, of course, once Brexit is concluded, we will be free to sign trade deals with other countries. We can't do that at the moment. But what we have done is we've started a trade review with China to look at what the options would be once the Brexit talks are concluded and we have left the European Union. So we would like to have clarity about a strong investment relationship with China, so possibly an investment deal, and then moving towards looking towards a free trade deal. But I think what's really important in that is that we continue our process of opening up the Chinese market incrementally, tackling cosmetics, agri-food, for example, petrol stations, financial services. And we don't hold our breath and put everything into negotiating a free trade agreement, which could take years.
How much of your time do you have to spend answering questions in China about Brexit?
I spend quite a lot of my time answering questions about Brexit, but broadly, we find that our relationship with China is bigger than Brexit. We've had a couple of very high-level visits, and we've been able to move forward at the government level, business level, and with strong people-to-people exchanges, students, tourists, and so on, around Brexit. But it has, I would say, held up a bit of Chinese investment that might have otherwise come to the UK.
I want to ask you about another big topic in the news right now, and that is what's going on with Iran.
Yeah.
Now, Britain is still in the nuclear deal with Iran, along with a number of other countries. The U.S. pulled out of that deal. What is the British position on the Iran nuclear deal right now? Will Britain stay in the deal?
So we would very much like to keep the deal alive because we think it's important for the long-term future of Iran and indeed wider global security and nuclear non-proliferation. But we recognize the recent announcements by the president of Iran giving us 60 days to try and get the deal back together again and make it robust. So we are working intensely now to see if we can keep the deal together and therefore keep Iran's civil nuclear capacity and prevent them returning to nuclear proliferation.
Is the US pressuring the UK to leave the deal?
There are talks going on among all of the parties of the deal. The US position is very clear, but at the moment we're working with the five other parties in the deal who we co-negotiated it with to try and see what we can hold together there.
And is there any concern in the UK right now about some of the rhetoric coming from Washington that leads some to believe that Washington is on a path to military action with Iran?
I think we would be concerned about military action with Iran. But as I say, at the moment, we're really focused on trying to keep the deal standing up and functioning so that we can move forward and avoid Iran returning to the path of nuclear proliferation.
I want to ask you about one more thing. We mentioned at the top that you are the first woman ever to hold the position that you have, which is the British ambassador to China. What is it like to have that, especially in a country where there are so few women at high levels of government?
Well, first of all, it's a huge honor. It's a fascinating job. It is strange to find so few women at the high levels of government, particularly compared to where the UK is now. Obviously, we have the Queen. We're on our second female prime minister. We have more than 30% of our members of parliament are women. And it's been quite noticeable in China. So we've taken a number of initiatives working with business. We ran a Pledge for Progress campaign last year, engaging business on how to bring women through. We've got a program going on in schools called Inspiring Women, where we talk to primary and middle school students early about the sort of careers you can have before their ideas are formed.
In China?
In China, yes. But I do find that there are not so many women in government in China. And I think it's a pity because we all know that diversity brings strength and breadth and challenge and, in the end, long-term progress.
Do you face discrimination there? I mean, do you notice anything, even if it's not really overt, but do you notice things just as you navigate your way around Beijing that people treat you differently because you're a woman in power?
No, I've found that I've always been treated with great courtesy and great respect by my Chinese colleagues and by my peers in the ambassadorial community. But you have to remember that China's not a particularly diverse culture, so people are Chinese. So if you have a female ambassador, I'm foreign, I'm taller than average, I'm a woman, I speak Chinese. So I'm kind of different in lots of respects, mm-hmm. and being a woman is only one of them.
That is Dame Barbara Woodward, who is the British ambassador to China. Ambassador, thank you so much for coming in.
Jeremy, thank you very much.
And now a story about a bunch of bones. Ancient fossils can tell us a lot about history, but in Austin, Texas, there's a trove of million-year-old bones that are also teaching us about the much more recent past. And as KUT's Mose Bushell reports, they may also tell us about what's to come in a changing climate.
That's right. The main characters in this story are a bunch of fossils.
You're about to head into the collections proper.
This is Chris Sagaville. He's the keeper of these ancient bones, officially the collections manager. They're stored in Austin in a huge World War II era warehouse. Now it holds row after row of shelves and cabinets. It's home to the University of Texas's vertebrate paleontology collection.
I never take this place for granted. Every day I come in, just love the environment. It's unique.
Isn't it? It's incredible. We're looking at these massive jawbones just kind of sitting on these shelves going up to the window here.
You've got a whole mammoth lower jaw. Looking at that number, I know that's one of our WPA specimens that was collected probably 1939.
WPA, 1939? What is he talking about? Turns out a lot of these fossils were gathered in the 30s, back when the economy was in the ditch.
The Great Depression left millions of able and willing Americans bewildered and jobless.
But the federal government had a plan. It launched the Works Progress Administration.
To take care of the unemployed, as well as to confer real and lasting benefits on the people of the United States, is the object of the WPA. Under this program, work pays America.
The government paid people to build roads, it paid people to paint murals, and in Texas, it paid people to dig up old bones. At least for a little while.
And then World War II happened, and that put an end to the research that was planned for all these different fossils.
So they just sat here, some in the same burlap and plaster packaging that they were wrapped in by those WPA workers 80 years ago. That is, until recently.
You should see the basement.
Let's go.
Yeah.
Sagaville leads me down a flight of stairs and unlocks the door to the lower level.
There's a lot more.
Things seem a little less tidy down here. It's more cramped and more of the bones sit out in the open.
So the material Steve was interested in are mainly along this wall.
Steve is UT researcher Stephen May. About 5 years ago, he reopened that old WPA collection and started poking around.
So, for example, we have a new gomphotheria, one of these kind of elephant-like creatures, that we've given it a new name, Blancotherium.
This is Steve May.
There's a fossil of something that's sort of a coyote-sized dog-like creature.
He says it could be a very early ancestor of modern dogs.
So there's some aspects like that that are very exciting.
But beyond new species, he says another interesting thing about the WPA fossils is their diversity. The collection paints a detailed picture of what South Texas looked like about 10 million years ago, long after the dinosaurs, but long before the arrival of humans.
So we have elephant-like creatures.
Camels.
Camel with a very long neck, so it's sort of giraffe-like.
Horse fossils.
So think zebra.
A weird alligator.
We have these rhinos.
Really a bizarre concept to think about rhinoceroses running around the state of Texas.
May has a term for this ancient time. He calls it the Texas Serengeti.
You start thinking about that composition of a fauna, and it sounds very much like some of the modern African savanna-type faunas today.
But hearing that, you've got to wonder, what happened to all these animals?
Well, that's a good question.
Experts say it was probably a bunch of things that wiped out most of them, even as their ancestors survived on faraway continents.
Of course, we don't know exactly.
Theories range from asteroids to overhunting when humans arrived. But Chris Sagaville says...
climate change is my preferred answer to that. There were large changes in the climate at the same time that all the large mammals in North America went extinct.
And by the time their bones were pulled from the ground in the 1930s, the Earth was again experiencing a changing climate. This one caused by man. The effects of that global warming are now accelerating. And that's why Sagaville thinks this research could be more important today than it was even back then.
So we can see what we might expect in the future. How quickly those effects can trickle down to the animals.
And there's still plenty more to study. There are still dozens of fossil packages in UT's collection that haven't even been opened. They could hold anything from a previously unknown animal to new clues about a great extinction. For Here and Now, I'm Mose Bouchel.
I'm so glad we had this time together.
I want to fit in this sad news. Actor Tim Conway has died. Oh, my gosh. His work with Carol Burnett, Dorf, the bumbling Scandinavian, Mr. Tudball, whose accent, he said, was inspired by his Romanian mother. And could it be the funniest skit in television history? Conway the dentist, Harvey Korman the patient.
I am in terrible pain. I want you to do something to stop the pain. Either fill the tooth or pull it.
Oh, gosh. See, in dental school, in filling and pulling, I only got C's. That was just kind of an average grade. I got A's in cleaning, though. You want me to clean it for you?
Will it stop the pain?
No, but it'll look great. What?
Google it. Tim Conway has died at 85.
When the time comes and I'm feeling lonely, and I'm feeling so blue, I just...
Here Now is a production of NPR and WBUR. Jeremy, we're going to be hearing much more about this life over the course of the day. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now.
That's why I'm glad we had this time together. Because it makes me feel like I belong. Seems we just got started. And before you know it, comes the time. Have to say so long.
Good night, everybody.